WorldMag.com presents a World Forum podcast in cooperation with the King's College, New York City. Visit them online today at tkc.edu. As part of the Distinguished Visitor Series, the King's College hosted Brian Gadawa, screenwriter and director. This interview was conducted by Marvin Alasky and recorded at the King's College campus in the Empire State Building.
I want to start out with how you started out. You now have movies like this. And many others that you've been involved in. How did you get to this point? Let's start with where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
Okay.
So I was a suburban boy, and my route to Hollywood is very, I mean, in some ways it's probably typical, but it's also not very flashy. I've just always been an artist, and I've drawn and done graphic design and all that all my life, and but I also happen to love movies. And so I watched tons and tons of movies when I was a kid and television, and by the time I got into high school and going into college, I made my own little movie, my own student film. And but I did it on the side. I actually studied the visual arts as an illustrator. I was trained as an illustrator and in advertising and marketing design. But I made movies and wrote screenplays on the side. And one of the reasons why was because the life of a writer has a lot of solitude to it. You have to spend many hours alone writing. And when I was younger, I needed much more social interaction with people. So I kind of like put the writing aside and focused on, you know, my involvement with my church and with people in my life, because I needed that. And it was too lonely. It was basically too lonely for me. And so I was living my normal life with a normal day job, but then I got married. And a year after I got married, I started writing and haven't stopped.
Let me back up for a minute. Trained how and where? Are you saying trained as an illustrator?
Trained as an illustrator and marketing and graphics. And so I studied screenwriting on the side. I'm self-taught, basically.
Okay.
Went to seminars, read all the books, and just basically wrote, because those are the three things that matter the most. And that's the great thing about movie making in general is, while degrees can certainly help, at least in Hollywood, what matters is what you've done. And so someone who can show me a great film, short film, tells me if they can make a good movie, not, oh, I went to New York, you know, NYU or something, or USC Film School. It certainly can help, and you can make connections through that. But ultimately, it's what you create that proves what you can do.
Okay, so you're working in advertising in your early 20s.
Yeah, my early 20s.
And you wanted to make films.
I wanted to make films. I've always loved movies, and so of course, when I became older, I wanted to make movies.
Right.
But it takes a lot to do so. So when you pursue that as a hobby on the side, you start to realize, wow, this would be a complete change of life, and I wasn't ready at the time to do that. So, yeah, in my 20s, but then, like I said, once I got married in my 20s, then I just started writing. I was able to write then.
Marriage.
I had the companionship, and okay. And I think, that's what satisfied me.
Okay, you could actually go home in the evening rather than go chasing in the
yes.
evening. Yes. Okay. All right. And so what was the first thing you wrote when you're getting really into this and you're married, you're more stable and so forth? What was the first thing you wrote?
Well, I wrote a few scripts. One on a lot of times what you do end up doing is you write something out of your life that, you know, oh, I've always wanted to write a movie about my life or something. So I wrote this family drama that was out of my own life, and it was terrible, of course, and no one's read it, and it's good that they didn't.
You still have a copy or did you destroy?
No, I still have all. I save everything I wrote, okay. So I definitely still
but
have
keep it.
Keep
it locked up.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Right. No one's going to read it. Right. I did a couple versions of it too. Did a play version. So it was good practice. And that's what they tell you is the first three scripts are usually just terrible anyway. So just keep writing, and that's the bottom line. Keep writing. That's how you get better. And there are very few people who right out of the shoot can write a script that's really good. So. And especially, like I said, if you're not taking class, if you're just studying on your own and you're learning on your own, it takes a little bit of extra effort.
Did you, at the time you were writing this, did you know the basic rule understanding about, you know, the first three are really not going to go anywhere, or was it crushing when they did not? Or
no, I did, because what I did was I'm a researcher, So whenever I want to learn something or do something, I go and buy a bunch of books. That's not always, that's only one small part, because ultimately you need to do things, not just read. But I'm like that. So I went out and read a ton of books on screenwriting, and they all told me the rules, and I believed them. I just accepted them as this is the Bible for this world, and they all told me that. So I just said, okay, well, that's fine. I'll just keep doing it, because I really wanted to do it. So.
Yeah. So when's your breakthrough? When do you actually get something?
Well, that's interesting, because part of the process is when you start to write, you do your scripts, when you're out in the middle of, you know, as we call it in Los Angeles and New York, flyover country, right. Which right. is where I was in Chicago, you just have to get noticed. You have to make connections, and you're not in the Hollywood world to make connections, so you need to do things like cold calling production companies, trying to get an agent. You join all the contests that you can. You enter your scripts that you write, and that's what I did. So I did that for many years. In fact, it was about 10 or 11 years before I actually had a first movie made. So I've been entering contests for that many years, writing, you know, about a script a year, and just building up, trying to get some awards, and I won some awards with my scripts that then become part of my resume, and then that becomes part of my pitch to other producers when I have projects. Oh, well, you know, I'm an award-winning screenwriter because I've, you know, won these screenwriting awards, or would you take a look at this script because it won this award at this contest, etc. And some of the contests are meaningless. Nowadays, more and more of them are meaningless. But there are some big contests that, if you have that on your resume, at least it makes you stand out enough to a producer to say, okay, this isn't just the old Joe on the street. They've done something that has accomplished something that makes me it worthy of at least considering the screenplay. Because, as we know, nowadays, everyone in the world is writing screenplays, and they've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, making phone calls and letters into L.A. saying, I've got a great screenplay to read. Well, they don't have time to go through a lot of that. So they usually just deal with studios, with agents and producers that they already know, and then, or connections that they already know, or if you have something that makes you stand out. And that's what you're always trying to do, is find that angle. It's so salesmanship.
So some of the contests are meaningless because the competition isn't very strong, or because everyone gets a blue ribbon for participation?
A little bit of all of that, and more of them now. Production companies have realized that one of the ways to search for a script for free is to have a contest. Because normally in Hollywood, you contact, as a writer, you either have agents or you go on your own, but you try to contact producers make the movies, and get them to read your script to produce it to make the movie. And in terms of the business, they do that for free. But, of course, it's you write them a letter, you have your agent call, and they say, we've got this great script about such and such. And they'll say probably 99% of the time, nah, not interested. But if it sparks their interest, ooh, that sounds like an interesting idea, and this writer has something that makes them stand out in some way, then they'll say, okay, send it in, we'll take a look at it. If they like it, they'll go forward. If they don't, they'll just pass and say, oh, thanks for your script, not interested. But, of course, to get them, they've got literally hundreds, you know, piles of scripts to go through. So you're always trying to stand out in some way. So if they're already doing this, and the normal process is, you, as a professional, you do that for free. If I'm interested in your script, I'll produce it and I'll make money off of it. So the way that they get around that is, you have a contest, some little production company that wants to make movies. Well, let's have a contest, such and such contest, send your scripts in. And what do? When you have a contest, you charge a fee to enter the contest. So it's like you're paying them to read your script, $30 to read your script. And then the award of the contest is, the award winner of the contest will be produced by this production company that happens to be having the contest, you see. So it's just a lot of that is a scam, and I wouldn't want to be a part of it. But some of the more established festivals out there, you know, are still worthy, you know.
So really, it's a whole decade you're writing.
Yes.
And you're occasionally getting some recognition, winning this contest, that contest, and things like that. Is that the... Where's the encouragement come from? How do you keep going for that length of time?
It's all within, because you don't get much encouragement at all. You know, it's been said around Hollywood that you have to have rhino skin. And I'm sure that that's actually very similar to the world of journalism as well, which means you have to get rejected a lot. Most everything you do gets rejected. And so you just have to keep pounding and pounding. And it's all from within your own personal vision that makes you keep going, that you still believe in what you want to do. Because, you know, I, for example, I would get a script and I would buy the Hollywood Creative Directory. This is another standard thing you do when you don't have an agent and you, or you're outside of Hollywood, you don't have connections. You know, you buy the Hollywood Creative Directory, which has hundreds of production companies in Hollywood. And you go down the list and you get all the companies that you think might be interested in your script based on material they've already done. You send out your query letter. So every script I would write, I would join 20 contests. I would contact a couple hundred production companies with my query letter, maybe get accepted to read the script at about 15, 20 of those, if you're lucky. You know, that's a good one, maybe 10. And then, you know, I basically kept all my rejection letters over the years. I've got hundreds of them. I think I heard Steve Martin make the joke that, you know, he papered his wall, you know, he did wallpapered his wall with his rejection letters when he finally broke into the business, so to speak. So it's rhino skin. You've got to be tough. But there's another side of Hollywood that's sort of the opposite, where they also say you can die of kindness, because there's so much facade in Hollywood too that nobody wants to burn bridges, because you never know who's going to be. You never know what small person is going to rise to become big in the future. So what will happen as well is, If you get people to read your script and they don't like it or it's not good, they won't say why. They'll just say, hey, good writing, but not for us. And so there'll be a lot of times people, it's not that they're cruel to you. Sometimes they are, but mostly they're nice to you and in an unhelpful way, because maybe it is terrible and you need to get better at it, but they won't tell you that because they don't want to, because, hey, someday you might rise up, right? So a lot of like, hey, good writing, good job, not for us. So in a way, you never know if you're really good or not, because all of the best writers in Hollywood have been passed on their scripts. And if you look at a lot of the Oscar winners through history, Schindler's List, you know, Steven Spielberg couldn't get Schindler's List made for 10 years. And that's how it is with most of these movies, where Forrest Gump was rejected by every studio in town. It's one of the best movies of all time. And it's also one of the biggest movie moneymakers of all time. And so you can see how there's this ironic juxtaposition in the world, in Hollywood, that terrible writers and great writers are equally rejected and passed on. So how do you know if you're a terrible writer or a genius who hasn't been discovered? You know, you just never know. So you just keep going out of your love for it and because you really want to do something. And again, many successful writers and directors and everything will tell you, the only reason why I'm here still is because I was the only one left standing after 10, 15 years. You know, everyone else sort of, you know, that was working with me at the same time gave up, and I just didn't give up. So it's sheer raw perseverance. And of course, as a Christian, I also believe that you know, God is involved in my life, and so for whatever reasons, he's blessed me with different you know, avenues, and I'm grateful for that.
When did you become a Christian?
In high school.
Okay. How did that happen?
17. Well, I was just a standard high school kid with a passion for art.
This is in suburban Chicago?
In suburban Chicago. And actually, I learned of Christianity through Willow Creek Community Church. Hmm. When they first got started, they had a youth ministry. I was raised as a Roman Catholic, but I didn't really believe in it, and I didn't care for it. And plus, I was like iconoclastic as an artist, so I was like against all that religious stuff, you know. But Willow Creek at the time, what was really fascinating about it was they had a youth ministry where they did rock music, had skits and drama and art. And they did a bunch of games with the kids, and I hated the games, but I loved the fact that they embodied the gospel in the arts. And then they had a guy come up, Don Cousins was his name, and he would talk to us high schoolers in a way that was really relevant, which I didn't get at my church. And so they made the gospel relevant to my life outside of this super religious context. And so I prayed and, you know, to receive Christ into my heart in the standard evangelical way. And he changed my life within over a period of a few years. He changed me from the inside out, because I didn't try to become a better person I just kept living as I was, but my heart was changed from within, and I started seeing things differently, and you know, in my moral life as well as just in my personal life.
Did that, as you're facing 10 years of, well, both rejection and mild approval, does being a Christian help you with that in a way, or hurt it in some way, or what difference would it make being a Christian going through this long, long process of trying to make it?
That's a very good question. It was very, very crucial. A very crucial time was when I first started out. And like I said, I read all the screenplay books, and they tell you the truth about Hollywood in there. They encourage you, but they tell you the truth. And the truth is, you know, 99% of people going for it don't make it. Lots of people spend their lives writing lots of scripts that never go anywhere. And I knew the reality that I could be working at this for 20 years. The possibility was. And you could even be good and not get movies made. So when I started out, I realized I could be working at this for 10, 20 years and not break in. So I asked myself what it takes to do quality art in any field, whether it's movies, visual arts, music. It requires a dedication. That means you don't have the time that a lot of other people spend socializing, hanging out, leisure time, blah, you know, blah, 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 because you're putting it into your art. And so I knew that if I was going to take all that time away from people and focus on the art to accomplish it, I basically looked ahead 20 years and thought, okay, if I do this and give up all this other time and other stuff and leisure and free time, and I don't get any movies made, Will I be satisfied? And what that did to me was it also made me look at my Christian life and say, well, what am I doing this for? And I had read Francis Schaeffer many years ago, and if you haven't, you know, you should. He's somewhat outdated now, so read Nancy Piercy's Total Truth to update Francis Schaeffer. But I read Francis Schaeffer, and he helped me to understand how Christianity applies to the arts, and how worldview is embedded within the arts. And because of that, I dedicated that the work I do, whatever it was I do it for the glory of Christ. Now, that doesn't mean I don't make Christian movies. I don't, as we know them. I'm not going to condemn any particular one, but we all know what they are. And some of them even make a lot of money, but I don't do that because I don't believe in it. I don't think propaganda is very effective, and I don't think it's preferable. But I do embed my worldview just like every artist does.
Sure.
And the stories that I tell, the stories I'm interested in, are stories that are about meaning, about truth, and about eternal issues in some way or manner. And so I decided that I was going to... This was going to be my ministry, one of my ministries, the most important one, which is I'm going to express the kingdom of God as best as I know it within my stories. Therefore, because I'm doing it for God, because I feel the calling of God on my life, just like a pastor feels the calling on his life, I committed to God and said, God, I'm going to pursue this, and I'm going to do it for you, which means if at the end of 20 years... If I've been put on the shelf, that's your prerogative. It's your problem because I'm doing it for you, and it's okay. And then I can say at the end of 20 years, I did it for Christ, and God chooses some people to have a lot of influence and some people not to have a lot of influence. And so in other words, it was addressing my pride too, because I also was raised with a typical evangelical attitude that I want to make a difference, and that's good, and I want to have a life of significance for God's kingdom. But it also brings in this creeping sort of pride notion of, I want to accomplish great things for God. And which sort of is, I want to be a Billy Graham, or I want to be a Marvin Oleski. No. I want to have a great influence for God's kingdom. And God does use some people in a special way like that. He uses them in a bigger way than others. But I realized that there was a subtle aspect of pride in there that if I don't have this fame for Christ, you know, if I don't create this big ministry or have this great effect and get thousands of people saved or whatever, you know, fill in the blank. There's this subtle notion of pride that then I haven't really accomplished much for the kingdom. And we have to realize that all of us are part of the kingdom, the different gifts in the body. And I came to realize that, you know, the janitor of the church, I mean, I really do see all the parts of the body as equally important. I don't think the pastor of a church is the most important part of the church. I honestly don't. And I think that all of them are, you know, whether it's the secretary or the, you know, on down, we're all equally part of God accomplishing his purposes, and we're equally valuable. When you really, I mean, you don't just talk about it, but when you really see the world that way, you start to interact with people that way and value them equally. And so the conclusion of that was it would be okay because maybe God just wants me to be an encouragement to other Christians who do make it through my own experiences, and that's okay. And as it happens, you know, yeah, I've started making movies, but it's been almost that many years, and I haven't made a lot of movies, but because I've told stories that I really believe in and that I believe are truthful, I am very satisfied with the fact that I'm not a big movie filmmaker with fame or any big success in that sense, but I'm confident and grateful and satisfied with the stories I've told because they do honor God and that they are truthful. And that's enough to satisfy me.
Now you've been, along with making movies, you've been writing some books in the past decade, a couple of books in particular that I recommend that are either in our library or soon will be.
They better be.
They better be, exactly. One's called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. First came out in 2002 and then a new edition last year. And then the other one is called Word Pictures, Knowing God Through Story and Imagination. And that's particularly interesting for us here, I mean, along with a lot of other people, but interesting for us here as we start this MCA program because, you know, media, culture, and the arts, I mean, a lot of it is pictures, a lot of it is drama, a lot of it is theater. And that's somewhat different in a way from the, I guess, what you call the logocentric orientation, where words are foremost and you're even a little bit skeptical about pictures and things like that. Could you talk a little bit about both within the church and then as far as appealing to people, what are the roles of words, what are the roles of pictures, how do they go together or sometimes combat?
Yeah. I wrote a lot of that. Hollywood Worldviews I wrote because I saw in the church my experience. You know, this was sort of like my ministry back to the church. I could just make my movies and be happy, but God convicted me that I need to share what I've studied for years and developed a strategy and a theology of movies and storytelling. And I got convicted that I have to share that with the church, otherwise I'm just selfish. So what if you make your couple movies? What good are you? So I looked at the church, and there's usually been the two extremes of what I call the cultural anorexic, who, because there's some bad things in movies, you know, there's sex and violence, therefore, you know, they're all bad. And I don't go to R-rated movies and all this kind of stuff. They throw the baby out with bathwater. And then there's the other extreme, which I get more of in Hollywood, in L.A., because it's a lot of lack of discernment. We just consume everything because either, A, it's just entertainment, or, B, they're part of the media whoring culture. And so because of those two extremes, I wanted to get a balance on watching films with discernment so you could – no movie's perfect. It's always a mixture of good and bad. And as adults, we need to be able to watch and interact with it redemptively, which is figure out what you like about it and agree with, and figure out what you dislike or disagree, and be able to take the good, reject the bad, and then interact with the world around you about it. And so I wanted to help Christians to understand the nature of storytelling in movies. Education. Word pictures was a lot of my own personal journey because as a Christian, I became a Christian kind of through apologetics and then philosophy. And so I've always had a rational emphasis in my Christian faith. I've always been an artist. And so I've had almost a bipolar or schizophrenic, you know, a beautiful mind sort of struggle in me between the arts in my artistic life, which I lived one way. But then in my faith, I started realizing My whole faith had been developed through apologetics and rational argumentation and philosophy, which is not bad. Of course, the Bible is very rational. You know, God is the Logos, etc. And there's reasoning in the Bible. But what I realized was that over the years, I had compartmentalized my life, and in the sense that my faith was very rationalistic, and so I would stress systematic theology, I would stress apologetics, rational argumentation, understanding doctrine, all these things which are important elements. But I realized that I had neglected the imagination side of Scripture. I had relegated that to, it's acceptable, because of course I was an artist, right? But I had started to see imagination, the arts, the visual, drama, all these things that are part of arts as secondary, as illustrations of the rational doctrine, as sort of a support, second-class status in terms of theology. Because, of course, we all know, as good evangelicals, that, you know, theological discourse and systematic theology, that's where you really get it down. And then I started realizing how much my Christianity had been affected by modernism. And realizing modernism, because of the Enlightenment, scientific and science and reason became the deities in a modern culture. And as Christians, of course, we spurn those deities. But I think I was heavily influenced by that to realize that systematic theology is the scientific method applied to understanding God. Again, it's not inherently bad, but it creates a prejudice, a bias in your understanding of God that can blind you to God's fullness of who He is. And I become so involved in that, again, through philosophy and apologetics, that I lost that imaginative connection. And so Word Pictures was expressing my journey of rediscovery of the imagination, which is not too unlike what C.S. Lewis went through. Mm-hmm. And I'm not likening myself to him, but when I read his little story about what he went through, I'm like, wow, I didn't know. You know, so C.S. Lewis always comes up with, whenever I learn something, some truth in my life, I discover C.S. Lewis said something about it already, you know? And and I know he's a hero here too. So anyway, I put that actually in the book, and it was this. When Lewis, there was a change in his life where he was heavily rational and logical and emphasized debating and all that. But then he had that debate with Anscombe, and it wasn't. And then he sort of switched and focused more on his fictional writing, and that's when Narnia came out. And it wasn't that he was running away from rationality; it's that he realized that the imagination can come into contact with truth in a way that rationality cannot. And so they're both needed, both necessary. And I had that same experience in my own life, only it wasn't just from this sort of Christian worldview perspective. It's in the Bible. And so I was looking in the Bible and discovering, wow, yeah, God used rationality, but you realize about 20-30% of the Bible is propositional truth. But about 70-80% is image, story, poetry, parable. God actually, it's not just that imagination is acceptable, it's biblically acceptable. It's that it's one of the dominant means through which God communicates who He is. And so rather than saying, oh, therefore imagination is, like the postmodern would say, therefore it's all imagination, rationality is a Greek construct, and cast it aside in irrationality. No, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that if in our theology we have, or if in our philosophy we have an epistemology, an ontology, and an ethics, but we don't have an aesthetics, we're not fully understanding God. Because beauty is a key part of how God communicates who He is to us. And it's in the Scriptures. So Word Pictures is sort of a little bit of my journey and a little bit of my biblical exegesis for you, for those who are in the arts or in media, to show you how much God values what you're doing in and of itself. And how much that should be applied to our faith, not just my artistic life, but then I've got my theology, and then I've got my Christian faith, which is somehow different. They're both equally ultimate in God's eyes, and I root it in the incarnation. If in the incarnation, Christ is the Word made flesh, and so consequently, if you overemphasize rationality, you'll have a scientific, it's like dissecting a frog. You'll be able to figure out the parts, but you've killed the frog, folks. The essence of the frog is the life. So you really are not fully understanding the frog. By the same token, if you find yourself awash in artistic imaginative creativity, you can also come to know God. You can miss his rational side. But in the incarnation, they're both equal, equally ultimate. And so in our understanding of God, we should have an equal ultimacy of how we approach God through word, through reason, through rationality, but also through imagination, through beauty. And that's sort of the point of the book, the argument that I make. And I hope that will help people to be balanced in their faith rather than just swinging from one extreme to another.
Yeah, and that idea of balance is very important. Let me just read a few quotations from the book just for students here. And stop me anywhere.
Stop!
Shouldn't have said that. You mentioned that important was your discovery of original sin.
I won't do it again.
Do it again. Or more precisely, the noetic rational effect of sin. That is, it's not just that our wills are fallen, our minds are fallen. Biblically, people are not unbelievers because they suffer the lack of reasons, historical verification, or scientific proof to believe. They are unbelievers because they know the truth about God and suppress that knowledge sinfully. And so you mentioned that you began to discover, I began to discover just what was lopsiding my Christianity and my communication. It was my devaluation of imagination. I had become logocentric. I had privileged rational discourse as the ultimate means of discerning truth, and neglected the legitimacy of emotion and imagination in understanding God. Reason had become a sort of idol to me.
Yeah,
and it was not well with my soul. Now you can stop.
Okay. Yeah. What I also say, and this was like a key element that I keep coming back to. I did this for much of my, sharing my defending the faith. A good logician knows that the appeal to pity is, of course, a logical fallacy, an informal fallacy, as we say. But guess what? Jesus appealed to pity in a lot of his arguments. In fact, the Bible does appeal to pity a lot. So it may be logically invalid, but it's biblically valid. The point being that that invalid arguments, believe it or not, in terms of the logical world, invalidity of an argument does not disprove the truth of the argument. It does not. It could be true. The argument could be invalid, but it could still be true. Now, the point there being that, yes, there sometimes in the real world. Here's the sad reality: in the real world, we do pursue to be rational and logical, and I definitely support that. But we also see rhetoric is also very convincing. And so we see all the time in our political discourse, right, all the logical fallacies that they're throwing out all the time, yet they work, and people are persuaded by them. And we get angry at that at times. But there's an ability to, I think, to mesh rhetoric, to mesh emotion with logic in a way that can be more effective. But when I see Jesus appeal to pity, for instance, in the Good Samaritan, I see, okay, if I stress only logical arguments, then I'm not touching the humanity of that person, and I need to include that in my interaction. I hope that's becoming clear. And there is a gray area in the real world of people that we live in that rhetoric. You can win an argument, but lose the battle. And I have seen people convinced, persuaded, and saved by complete rational idiots who are making bad arguments for the faith. And that doesn't justify going out. I'm not saying go out and do bad arguments. You know, obviously you should understand what I'm saying here. You should try to be consistent, et cetera. But to recognize that it's not just that. It's not just the logo centricity that's going to affect people's lives. It's also understanding humanity and realizing, and this is the key thing, in the arts and in rhetoric, there are means of persuasion that are not rational. That doesn't mean they're illegitimate. Notice I'm not saying irrational, but I'm saying they're just not rational. So they appeal to things that transcend rationality. Like, for example, the appeal to motion. And so the ability to understand that truth and use that, interact with it, is part of being human. And I think that the Bible includes a lot of those transrational notions. And so I think as Christians, if we want to be balanced, we have to include that in our understanding of our faith.
Yeah, as Pascal said, the heart does have reasons. And
which I used to scoff at, that Pascal, yeah. But now, and Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
And but now I'm you know, it's not like I know that I embrace them fully, but now I accept a lot of things that people like that said because I understand them in a different way now.
Yeah, and so the key is balance. Let me just quote one other thing, and then I want to just mention a few things from the other book, Hollywood Worldviews, but just from this book, you mentioned, and again, these two sides. Some Christians have tended to be so word-oriented that they border on rationalism and distrust the use of imagination, deeming it an idle tool of the devil's workshop. Meanwhile, other Christians have tended to be image-oriented with a more experiential approach to their faith and a distrust of dogmatic reasoning as closed-minded bigotry. But again, we want to have respect both for reasoning and for the imagination. I mean, that balance is important. So just a thing to keep in mind as we're developing this MCA major. Now, Hollywood Worldviews, you start out that God loves movies. And you mentioned dreams and visions. I mean, God's form of television and movies. I mean, talk a little bit about as you read the Bible and what do you see?
Yeah, well, you know, movies are basically visually dramatic stories. And, of course, they didn't have movies back then. So, you know,
no?
What would Jesus do? Would Jesus drive a BMW? Would Jesus watch a movie? The principle here is God does love visually dramatic stories. And then I went through a list of stuff. Well, first of all, God is very visual. You look at all the dreams and visions. And, I mean, the book of Revelation, folks, come on. I mean, Daniel. You know, I mean, this stuff is just, you know, the book of Revelation is actually an epic horror fantasy, like Lord of the Rings. It is. That's the genre of it's apocalyptic literature, but it's epic horror fantasy because there's horror images in there, fantasy, all this kind of stuff. Now, no matter what interpretation you have of Revelation, right? So everyone agrees that there's it's symbolic, etc. So it's very visual. God uses a lot of visual things to communicate his truth. You know, I didn't even realize this until I started studying it. Several of the prophets, Ezekiel and Jeremiah, they actually engaged in performance art as prophecies. Little performance art. And that was the prophecy. So
the Ezekiel show, the Jeremiah show.
Yeah, Jeremiah is referred to as the weeping prophet. I think he should be called the acting prophet because so many of his prophecies were acting. Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, God loves drama. Obviously, the Bible is mostly narrative. God's truth is communicated mostly through stories and through narrative. Yeah, they're true. Most of them are true. There's a lot of parables. But the point is God chose not to do a systematic theology to communicate his truth to us. We are the ones who have soteriology, ecclesiology, allegiologies, okay? God, and you know, don't tell me that they're primitive, you know, they're primitive and they didn't have this understanding. You know, the writers of the New Testament were in a Hellenistic culture. They were very abstract and philosophical. They could have chosen to write that way, but they chose not to. So narrative story is God's dominant means for communicating his truth. What that means is story communicates truth in a different way than a logical argument does, doesn't it? It, in a sense, story embodies the logical argument in a very real sense. And I explain that in Hollywood Worldviews, how it does that. And then, of course, visually dramatic stories. Oh, that's kind of both. Drama and stories are kind of, in some ways, different things saying the same thing. But So all these elements are the essence of movies. And so, in principle, because God values visually dramatic stories so well, I'm convinced that he loves movies as a means of communication. And I'm not saying he loves all movies that are out there, of course.
Right.
You always have to qualify yourself for the evangelical market. There are, you know, I'm known as the apologist for R-rated movies, you know, because I have an article or a chapter in Hollywood Worldviews about sex and violence and profanity in the movies and in the Bible. And, of course, the Bible is rated R, actually. Therefore, that means all R-rated movies are okay. No, of course not. Of course I'm not making that argument. But you always have to qualify yourself because people hear what they want. We've got all of our evangelical prejudices, and we jump to conclusions because we hear them saying one thing, and we jump to conclusions, you know. And we just have to be careful.
Yeah. I'm going to go to questions in a moment, but just...
of course, not you guys here, I know. I know, you're not like that.
Yeah. I think that's actually true.
Yeah, I actually believe that. I hope that.
Yeah. And again, this is not an anti-intellectual argument, as you write.
Exactly.
You know, unlike some Christian anti-intellectuals, God considers logic to be an important part of understanding him. But again, the emphasis here is on balance. The Bible, you write, is the story of God's redemptive activity in history. It communicates doctrine and theology mostly through stories. Very different from the Quran in that way, if you've ever read that and compare the two. And so this is important to understand. And again, you write more about the importance of reason and also the importance of story. And let me just mention one other thing, because one of the things we get in World, because in World magazine, I mean, we review R-rated movies, and we get letters. We do. I know you don't want to sit here with a sinner, but I'm sitting with you. You can sit with me. This is Philippians 4:8, and I'm sure many of you have heard this because we hear it a lot. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. End quote. And then you go on to say, contrary to some interpretations, this passage does not depict Christianity as an episode of VeggieTales. It is also true, honorable, and right to show the suicidal, rotting flesh of Judas, the betrayer of the gospel. You go on to say the portrayal of good and evil, as well as their consequences, are two sides of God's one honorable, pure, lovely, excellent, and praiseworthy truth. According to the Bible, pointing out wrong is part of dwelling on what is right. Exposing lies is part of dwelling on the truth. Revealing cowardice is part of dwelling on the honorable, and uncovering corruption is part of dwelling on the pure. That's something which we'll be using in World as we get attacked, and you get attacked occasionally for reporting on nasty stuff. But look, if you want to understand the way the world is, there's going to be a huge amount of gruesome reporting coming out of Haiti, and that's part of the world, and that's part of the way things are. And we're not supposed to just be, you know, VeggieTales are great for kids and for vegetables.
Yeah, I'm always amazed when Christians come to me with those kind of arguments. I'm like, look, read your Bible. I mean, the Bible is full of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would challenge you, okay, the Bible's holy, okay. I challenge you to read Ezekiel chapter 16 or chapter 23 to your Sunday school junior, or not junior high, you know, grade school kids. You're not going to do it. You're not going to read Song of Solomon in the church, are you? You're reading an R-rated book, and yet you're sitting there criticizing this. You know, that's basically a double standard is what that is. Of course, then when they say, yeah, but this in the Bible, it really happened. Well, a lot of it didn't. There's a lot of parables. And like I said, there's a lot of symbolic imagery that's not literal. It's symbolic. So you know, there's a tale of multi-headed beasts, mutated, huge Godzilla-like multi-headed beasts running around eating people. Well, that didn't literally happen. Yeah, it's symbolic about what's going to happen in history. But the point is, the story itself didn't happen that way. So your Bible has all this stuff in there. It even has blasphemy in there. Yes. Why? Yes, of course, most of it did happen, but not all of it did. And the point of it is, what's the context? It's moral instruction. It's ultimately within the context of a moral message theme that God is you know, condemning evil and elevating goodness. But you got to have both in there to show them together. And yes, it's not X-rated, but it certainly is R-rated. Yes, it doesn't show everything all the time. But it does sometimes. It's sometimes explicit, sometimes it's not. The point is there's sometimes a reason to do so. And usually it's when you're dealing with a serious moral failure or issue, you have to be shocking to a certain degree, just like God is. When God wanted to show the spiritual failure of Israel, his favorite imagery was whores, prostitutes, and sluts. And he described what they did. So my point is that's the thing that punches you in the gut. That's the thing that reveals spiritual evil that scares you away from that and inspires you towards holiness. And that's why horror genre is my favorite genre.
And I suspect in taking Noel Rabinowitz's class, as most of you have, I hope that at some point in the lecture you read and perhaps he discussed, you know, an example of the horror right towards the end of the book of Judges. There's a woman who was gang raped and then cut up into 12 pieces, and her body is FedExed. The 12 parts of her body are FedExed to the 12 tribes. This is not only in terms of symbolism and so forth, but this is a real, live, sad, miserable event that shows that there was no king in Israel, that they did not recognize God as their king. Questions? Yeah, Bethany.
Excuse me.
Where do you draw the line? Because I know you're saying, of course, that not all R-rated movies are bad, but of course there are some that are very bad. So where do you draw the line between maybe even porn and R-rated movies, something that we know is absolutely wrong and something that's a bit more relative?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And in Hollywood Worldviews, I try to give principles rather than what I think a lot of the, you know, fundamentalist or, you know, more rigid Christians try to do with these movies are bad, this is bad, that's good. I try to give principles rather than tell you what is good or bad. I do have to give some examples in my mind, but we're adults and we have to make decisions, and there's no perfect situation. There's no easy, perfect situation. The principles are, I give like three different principles, all of which are under the category of context, of course. But the intent of the intent behind the depiction and portrayal is very important. You know, if you have a movie that's intending to, you know, titillate and encourage adultery, like Bridges of Madison County, which actually that would be considered relatively tame because it's a love story and it's not explicit. But the fact is the morality of that, I would argue, is that it does elevate adultery as a, you know, ultimately a good loving thing. Versus Fatal Attraction, which is like R-rated, but it definitely shows the evils of adultery. And that movie is more explicit. Well, I would say Fatal Attraction is morally better. I wouldn't say it's perfect in that I would recommend it for everyone. And I do think that there's, like, for example, there's too much nudity inappropriately, unfortunately, in Fatal Attraction. But where we draw the line is in each of our personal adult lives, and we have to interact with each other, take challenges and such. And if you have, if you have a personal weakness, like I think men should be more careful about when movies have more visual nudity in it, because I don't think that that's appropriate. But I also think there are ways that you can deal with that, such as not looking, fast forwarding, or whatever. And let me give an example. I was speaking on a talk show, and someone called in about Schindler's List, which I was, you know, talking about. And this is a woman. She says, "How can you support that movie?" Because it had that scene with when he was in bed with that woman. I said, "Yeah, and I don't agree with that, but it was a 1 second shot. And you're telling me that a 1 second inappropriate shot that you can look away or whatever in that movie ruins the entire movie that shows the moral atrocities of the Holocaust? You're wrong. It's not perfect because we live in an imperfect world. But if I then have to walk out and not see the movie at all and not even recommend it because of 1 second, well, then I should walk out of most of the sermons I listen to because I don't agree with them all, you know? So my point there is, okay, that's an easy line to draw. To me, it's an easy line to draw that say pornography is wrong because it clearly violates scripture that I think, you know, do not look upon the nakedness of another, and the context of that is clearly erotic, you know, in my mind, as I understand it, erotic, and so that's inappropriate. But then how much, you know, and then they show a little bit, but not a lot. these are things we have to discuss, and I don't think there's a black and white. But I do think you do have to, as an adult, take into consideration the intent, the results. Are they show? You know, are the consequences for sin shown? Because you know, Proverbs chapter 7 actually brings you into the adultery. The sights, the smells, it describes what it's like to be drawn into that woman who's drawing him into the adultery. It's very vicarious. And then the trap slams shut. Because the purpose of it is there's a certain amount of vicarious experience the Bible wants you to be drawn into that sin. So at least in your mind, you're kind of sensing it so that when the moral trap closes, you can feel the impact of it. So there's a certain degree in which the way storytelling pulls you into an argument is necessary. But if it's going to end up doing that just to leave you there, then it's exploitation. But if it's drawing you into a certain degree, like a fatal attraction or an unfaithful, in order to show you the immorality of it, then it would be a little bit more acceptable. But then also there are some, language. You know, I think, you know, you have to decide. Certain amount of language shows reality. It's part of showing the truth. But if it becomes excessive, then it is inappropriate and maybe worth walking out. But we have to draw the lines for ourselves, and we have to be careful not to judge and impose this on others. We need to argue why we think. But this legalistic thing that we've had in the church for many years, where we're not listening to people and considering what they have to say because we're judging them rather than trying to share and listen, we're not going to get over this issue where there's an obsession on the level of shallow issues of sex, violence, and profanity, but they're missing the deeper issues of the worldview and the meaning and message of the movie, and that is inappropriate itself, you know. So the principles, context, intent, and then level of depiction. Sometimes it might be too much. So we have to argue with each other to find those levels and take into account your own personal weaknesses. If you tend to sweat cuss a lot, then maybe you should avoid movies that have a little bit more cussing in them. You know, personal level.
Hey, I'm Noah Hunter. I'm a senior here. I was wondering what you thought about James Cameron's Avatar. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Twice.
Just visually and even the story that he puts forth. And what does this mean for movies going forward?
Yeah.
Do you think most of them will end up becoming 3D pictures? So,
you know, I don't know. The technical side, the visual side, the special effects side, yeah, it's all beautiful. And that's why I loved about it, what everyone else did. It is a game changer in the business. Whether or not they're all going to be 3D, I just don't know. I don't care really myself right now. I don't think it's going to matter to me. But I love it as a medium, 3D, the way they're doing that. I'm actually writing an extensive analysis of Avatar right now for the next journal, Christian Research Journal. And my worldview conclusion is that I think it's a genius film. It's got a lot of faults. Two-dimensional characters, bad dialogue. Oh, Sigourney Weaver's terrible. Everyone, where's my cigarette? You know, don't do anything stupid. I mean, a lot of cliches. All the critiques of it, I agree. But they're all, you can't dismiss something that huge. You can't. And I'm on Cameron's side because in the sense of he's influencing the world. The world is getting, he's telling the stories to the world that all his critics are dismissing, but they're missing the point. My conclusion is that I think one of the reasons why it's so hugely successful is because Cameron is a brilliant myth maker. He appeals to the mythology of a culture, and I think Avatar is on the level of the Epic of Gilgamesh, or the Enuma Elish, or the Baal cycle in Ugarit. Which these are myths that embody not only nature worship and expressing that pantheistic deity, but the way myths work in terms of when Babylon rose to power in the early Babylonian period, the Epic of Gilgamesh was written to embody Marduk. It was about the rise of Marduk to power, which Marduk was the god of Babylon. and how he created everything, etc., and his chaos conf, his struggle with the forces to create of chaos to create order. Well, the purpose of myth is like a, sort of a justification of the worldview or the mythology of a culture. It embodies that. So when Babylon rises to power, it writes this creation myth that sort of embeds it in people's minds and hearts. And I think that's what Avatar is. Because I think there are three... I think that a global earth worship and nature worship is the rising religion that is at war with Christianity. The other one is, of course, Islam. The three ones that are fight. And I think earth worship, as embodied in environmentalism, global warming cult, all that stuff, I think that it's a rising, ascending power. And he's connected into that myth. And that's why I think, you know, it's worldwide, it's global. And the fact that it's multicultural, you know, it's, you know, he uses, just like the Matrix, he uses all these elements from different religions, messianic faiths, including Christianity. Obviously, he also attacks Christianity. But there's Hinduism. The blue creatures are blue deities in Hindu. You know, he's got, of course, animism and pantheism and American natives. So it's got this sort of like world, you know, which is very popular now, the multicultural, all religions are good, and let's learn as long as they're not Western and as long as they're not Christianity. Because they'll even support the Western murder religion of Islam as long as it's against Christianity. So I think that that's the heart of it, and that's why it's so popular. It's anti-American. People, it's really in vogue right now. So he appeals to the current zeitgeist in his storytelling, and for that he's a genius. And I'm jealous of him. I'm jealous of... I think we're in a war of gods. We're not in a culture war. We're in a war of gods. And I want Yahweh to be glorified in storytelling, and I'm jealous for Yahweh that he's not glorified, you know, in stories like that. So, I get inspired, just like when I read the Epic of Gilgamesh and understand the culture of that time. And so I also am inspired. We need you guys, we need to tell the stories too. We need... And, you know, there are movies actually with Christian mythology out there. I'm amazed that they get made, honestly. Knowing with Nicolas Cage, yeah, it's not perfect. It's, again, aliens and Chariots of the Gods stuff a little bit in there. But it's also got very strong Christian imagery. I Am Legend with Will Smith, you know. And then upcoming one, The Book of Eli with Denzel Washington. I mean, we're getting some stories out there, too. And Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings, you know. So it's not like God's not getting his voice out there, but... so that's all I'm writing about all that in the article too. So you'll want to read it.
Right at the end there, you mentioned the Chronicles of Narnia. We do have a House of Lewis here, and you've mentioned a few things about Lewis. What are your thoughts on the movies that have been made on so far, and as they're going forward? What do you think of them? I assume you've seen them.
Yeah, I like the first one, and the other ones are dumb. That's always how it is. By the way, I'm a Tolkien fan, so I'm in the Tolkien camp of... I didn't like Lewis's fiction that much. So while I did love Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, I preferred Lord of the Rings myself. But I also, what I think what happens too is that... And this is another issue why we need more of you in Hollywood. Stop seeing Hollywood as a Sodom and Gomorrah to flee and create our little Christian subculture that's going to make just as good of movies that everyone will watch, because we don't want to be a part of the evil system of Hollywood. Well, it's not going to happen because nobody, you know, it's terrible stuff. But we need you to stop seeing it as Sodom and Gomorrah to flee and see it as a mission field of unreached people groups, because... Narnia is a perfect example. I don't know all the details, but the Christians are in control of that story. Now, they couldn't hide it because it was so embedded. You can't hide it. You can't hide Aslan, right? And the table, the sacrifice. But in the stories after that, have they made two other ones now, or just one other one? Yeah, well, they're hiring like non-Christians to direct it, which means, you know... They might be true to mythology, because unfortunately, non-Christians have told Christian stories better than Christians have. Chariots of Fire. You know, you can go through a long list of them. But it's still in. You can all. They can also ruin it because they don't get it, or they're trying to twist it, or sort of suppress it. And so, consequently, we need Christians to be able to become the good directors, so that they can get in to be the director of the next Narnia, you know, movie or whatever. But you've got to get good and respectable to the point where they'll respect you enough to be able to do a project like that. So that's the hard road that we have to follow. But we need to get in there and tell our stories too. So. Yeah, I don't know if that answers or addresses what you were asking.
Let's see. Yeah, Bethany, you can ask another, and then if we have time, Josiah, that's fine.
Okay. Also, what about scripture that talks about avoid all appearances of evil, flee evil, like avoid temptation, that type of stuff? How do you reconcile that with watching R-rated movies that you know will have nudity and you know will have, like, adultery and things that we know for a fact are evil?
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is pretty much the same answer to your previous question. I mean, it really is. And if you want to get a more exegesis about that, you know, read the chapter on sex and violence. But, I mean, again, in general, it's when the Bible says flee evil, but it also gives you detailed descriptions of evil. So obviously, exposing yourself to evil in a story that has the context of good is obviously not the same as, or that's not imbibing evil. So, you know, in other words, reading, listening, watching a story that deals with evil is not the same as engaging in evil. And so, but, of course, the meaning and message and context is what determines that. So I would argue that a movie that is exploiting violence, I would argue an example of that might be Kill Bill. Some people might disagree, but let me just, I would say Kill Bill. Because it's all about violence as an art and showing creative ways of killing people and, you know, the dance of blood and all this. Whereas a movie that's equally as violent, Braveheart, I don't think it is. And so I would tend to avoid movies like Kill Bill, but tend to stress movies like Braveheart. You know? Because one exploits, the other one exposes. It's always, I come from evangelical, and even my past fundamentalist, I used to be years ago, but I come from evangelical background, so we always tend to, we got to have a Bible scripture to prove everything. And I still have that residue in me, because in my book, that's what I do. I show lots of scriptures to show that, you know, yeah, the Bible has some explicit sex and violence in there. So if it does, and if you can expose yourself to sex and violence in God's Word, then you should be able to in other realms as well. Doesn't justify all of it, and you have to get the principle. What are the principles? So, yeah, but it does, at least in principle, provide you with the biblical justification that in some cases it's appropriate.
And know your proclivities.
Yeah.
That, I think, is crucial in this. And Josiah, if you can ask a quick question, we can have maybe a quick answer, and then we'll be done.
I'm just curious, what are you working on now? I mean, besides your article, what are you working on?
That's a very good question. Right now, I finished a documentary this year on stem cell research called Lines That Divide. And I did it for a bioethics organization. It is available online at linesatdivide.com, but we don't have a distributor yet. We're just trying to show it around. We've shown it in D.C. to lawmakers and stuff. And it's an hour documentary on the issue of stem cell research. And we're educating people what you're not being told, basically. And so I do documentaries. That one is just now out. And we just wrapped shooting and editing the first cuts of a movie called Alleged at the Monkey Trial, which is a retelling of the Scopes Monkey Trial story. And we did it kind of like a Titanic, where it's a fictional love story between a young couple, the guy's a young journalist wannabe, and told in the context of the true story so that we could have more entertaining interest. And it tells of, rather than trying to deal with all the legal things, which are kind of boring, of the trial, and rather than making it some kind of anti-evolutionary thing, which we weren't as interested in, we were interested in the moral implications of evolution. So we deal with the the eugenics issue of the day, which no one ever deals with. Mm-hmm. And the story is mostly about how H.L. Mencken influences our journalists, teaches them the ropes about journalism, which, of course, is yellow journalism and how to twist and manipulate the truth to create your own news. And so it's really more about how that occurred, you know, exploring that, which I think is relevant for in today's world, right? And so I'm excited about the story, but you never know if a movie's going to turn out good, because from the point of writing it to the point of release, a million things can change that I don't know. So I don't know. We're hoping to have it released maybe by next year. It's independent. And we are in the process of getting funding and casting for a horror film on a serial killer, about a serial killer that I wrote called Cruel Logic. And if you want to find out more about any of this stuff, go to Gadawa.com. That tells you all the movies I'm into or that I'm working on or have made, little clips and stuff. And also, but if you want to find out more about the, you know, Hollywood worldview stuff, analyzing movies, articles, free articles about Christianity in the movies, go to HollywoodWorldviews.com. And that, so I deal with that material on that website. And I have a Facebook group. It's so funny. One time, somebody said this. I still want to use it in a line in a movie sometime. Some mother who doesn't really know what's going on, but she says, "So what is that? Maybe I should get involved with that." My Face or Spacebook? One of those things. My Face or Spacebook? You know, it's like no, Mom. It's Facebook and MySpace. But there's a Facebook group, Hollywood Worldviews, that I have movie blog of all the movies I see, and I write my little analysis and stuff. So if you want to hear more on that, you can go to the website. That's a good way to end, I think.
Yeah, and two things. Next week is Ruby Wade week. So we have on Tuesday Susan Metaxas, who's head of the Midtown Pregnancy Support Center, and she'll be interviewed by Eric Metaxas, her husband. And those of you who know Eric, he's a very funny guy. Wednesday, Clark Forsythe, who's been the chief lawyer for a number of years for Americans United for Life, and he can talk about the legal and political aspects. And then on Friday, Tim Geoghegan, who's now with Focus on the Family, was President Bush's liaison with evangelical groups. And, you know, it's a week to think about this will be the 37th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and 50 million fatalities because of that, coming out of that. So I hope you can come. Please join me now in thanking Brian Gadawa.
Thank you for listening to a World Forum podcast presented by WorldMag.com, the online home of World Magazine. Subscribe today by calling 800-951-6397 or visit WorldMag.com. This World Forum podcast is produced in cooperation with the King's College, New York City. The interview is used with permission. Visit their website today at tkc.edu.